Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer. SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting.
Than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience.
With Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I am your host, Nick Agar Johnson, and back again with my former co-host who has decided to not abandon me for a one-day span here, Tyler Metcalf. Tyler, how are you doing this fine evening?
Nick, I'm fantastic. Always excited to talk hoops. I mean, we got sports galore right now, NFL draft this week, NBA playoffs, NHL playoffs, baseball going on. I mean, just it's a fantastic time of the year.
Your basketball team is still alive in the NBA playoffs. Mine is unfortunately not, but the fact that there was a chance that both the Timberwolves and the Sacramento Kings could be in the playoffs at the same time was a wild thought. And alas, we missed out on the dream, but Timberwolves are still doing great.
So far, so good. Well, we're recording before they tip off game two on Tuesday night, so we'll see. Fingers crossed that Anthony Edwards keeps looking like a superstar, because, man, is that fun.
That definitely helps things in Minnesota. So let's talk about your most recent article. And your article was on one of the more polarizing prospects in this draft, in Tijan Salloon. And the thing about Salloon, I do want to start with a very specific point that you make sort of early on in the piece. And I'm just going to quote directly from you here because you said it far better than I could. I'm a firm believer that it's really important to start with the exciting aspects of a prospect when evaluating them before diving into the areas of improvement. And this is something that, you know, I spent a decent amount of time on when I wrote my sort of why I write about the NBA draft article a couple of years ago. Of so much of the fun of this for me is the hope. And with Salloon, you know, there's, as you say, you know, there are definitely areas of improvement that you could look into, but a lot of the fun of this process is the hope. And certainly with Salloon, there's a lot of hope that he could turn into a lot of different positive aspects of an NBA player at the next level.
Yeah. And before we dive into him specifically, just whenever I either watch a player for the first time, or we kick off a season and, you know, start watching college basketball right away, or it's the summer and we're like diving into guys' high school film from the year before, I want to figure out why I should be excited about a guy and keep that open mind, be optimistic, see what they do at a really high level, that warrants excitement, that warrants the joy that sports are supposed to provide. At the end of the day, this is supposed to be fun. You know, these guys are working to achieve a lifelong dream, to achieve the pinnacle of, you know, be the 1% of the 1% of the 1%. And if you just go into it with the mindset of, oh my God, this guy sucks, it's like, oh, he can't shoot. Yeah. It's like, okay, but he's a really good ball handler. He's a really smart playmaker. He's an awesome defender. He can do this or that or that. Or, you know, it's like, ah, man, his defense sucks. It's like, yeah, but he's an offensive dynamo who can do a bit of everything. I think that's the way that you should start, you know, just a little philosophy on my end. But I think that's how you should approach watching a guy for the first handful of times to kind of get a feel for him. And then that's when you start nitpicking and, you know, okay, yeah, this is a hole. How damning is it? This is a hole. How improvable is it? Is this a weakness because he's not asked to do it or because he can't do it? So sports are supposed to be fun. And this whole evaluation process is supposed to be fun and exciting. And there's so much negativity and just trash out there all the time that if you immediately go into it with a negative and pessimistic mindset, I just don't get what the appeal in that is.
Sports is supposed to be fun. I think we're done here. We can skip the rest of the podcast. No, but I think it's a very important message. I mean, certainly it jives very directly with my draft philosophy too, but I think it's an important message, especially this is the time of year. You know, college basketball is done. Most international leagues, if not wrapped up already, are getting to the point where they're wrapping up, and it's nitpicking season, essentially. And especially with this year's draft class, where there's, you know, this very widespread sort of thought of, you know, this draft class is not that strong at the top, right? There's so much room for just, oh, what can this guy not do? What is this guy not good enough at? And, you know, again, that takes away so much of the fun of it, of like, especially given that we're now in sort of nitpicking season, I think it's very valuable to sort of take that step back and be like, well, hold on a minute. Like, if I'm looking at this player as a potential first round pick, you know, there has to be something that I like in their game, right? And maybe drill in on that rather than like, oh, you know, this guy isn't a good enough ball handler. Okay, but is he ever going to have the ball in his hands? Does that matter all that much, right? It's like evaluating the prospects just purely based on what they can't do. You know, it's important to be, you know, fair and balanced, I think is the wrong way of putting it. But, you know, that sort of concept, right, of you can't just sort of say, oh, well, this guy can't shoot, but I'm ignoring that because, man, I really love the way he gets up and down the floor, right? You can't go that far to the other extreme. But again, you know, the process is supposed to be fun. And if all you're doing is just digging into the negatives, 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 negatives all the time, you know, especially at this time of the year when so much of the film is out there and a lot of the process is just sort of going back and figuring out, okay, where do I finally stand on this player? You know, I think it's still important to keep in mind that there are positive aspects of them, which is the reason why you bought in the first place. And if all you do is go back and pick the nits, you're going to move everybody down your board, no matter what draft class, but particularly in this year's group.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, neither of us are saying that you just ignore the weaknesses or areas that a guy has to improve, because that's a crucial part of the whole evaluation process. But to just only focus on those, it's what's the point? Because you're ignoring so much of their game and so much of what their appeal is. Yeah, do some of those weaknesses detract from them potentially being an all-star or a superstar? Yeah, absolutely. Is there, you know, that franchise cornerstone in this draft? Probably not. But that doesn't mean that there aren't a ton of really good role players. How many times do we see guys who are limited in one area or another find a role and just make it to contract after contract and find role after role after role on solid teams because they play to their strengths? NBA teams, I know, despite public opinion, aren't stupid. They kind of know what they're doing for the most part.
I think 10 years ago, either of our fan bases could have argued about our front offices.
Very fair. But the vast majority of these coaching staffs aren't going to throw a guy out there in a superstar role if he doesn't have those capabilities. Instead, they're going to put them in spots where they can develop and where they can grow and where they can help the team win. Is that as a superstar? Is that as a heliocentric creator? Probably not. That doesn't mean that they don't have value. That doesn't mean that they aren't a legitimate NBA talent. And just because a guy goes through a cold stretch of shooting at the end of the year doesn't mean that he's now all of a sudden a bust and a horrible player and doesn't deserve any praise as, you know, a lottery prospect. So it's finding that nuance and making sure that you kind of balance that optimism with the pessimism and what's real and what's not and all, just all of that.
And I think part of this too is that, you know, Saloon is the ultimate lottery ticket is the title of the article, right? But basically everybody in the draft is a lottery ticket to a certain degree. I mean, yes, last year there was such an obvious head of the class in Victor Wembanyama, and what we've seen from him his rookie year, it seemed like, yeah, he's going to be pretty good. He's already pretty good. He's a decent basketball player. He has some idea.
I think he'll make it.
Yeah, he'll be fine. But, you know, I'm thinking a lot with this year's draft class about the last draft class that I think was sort of similar to this one. And for me, that's 2013. And, you know, I thought that I wasn't as deep in the weeds in the draft as I am now by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, I thought Victor Oladipo was probably the clear, well, not probably. I think he was the clear best prospect in that class. He didn't end up going number one. But the point being, there was enough sort of uncertainty around him and around the rest of the top of the class that, you know, we're not all that sure. And, you know, that class ended up having a multi-time MVP. They just weren't picked in the lottery, right? It was Giannis going 15th. And, you know, that's such an, you know, over the top sort of comparison in the sense of the odds of anyone in this class becoming Giannis are next to nil, but they're not zero. And that's, I think, part of the point is with these prospects, if you're looking at, okay, just, you know, if you're looking at just the weaknesses, obviously you're going about it the wrong way. If you're looking at just the strengths, you're, I think, also going about it the wrong way. But, you know, ultimately with these players, you're trying to get an idea of what works. And some of these guys, you know, they come into the league and, you know, like the ultimate example of this in many ways is Kawhi Leonard of, oh, you know, he's coming into the league as if only he could shoot, he'd be, you know, an excellent 3-and-D player. And by year one, he's figured out the shooting. And, you know, by year five, he's an MVP candidate, right? Like, again, the odds of also the 15th pick, oddly enough, but, you know, the odds of anybody sort of having that kind of success story is extremely slim. But the flip side of that is we don't know. Ultimately, like, you know, we do our best to try and figure these things out. But every year there's a player who surprises in a positive sense. Every year there's a player who people thought were a relatively sure thing that flames out a lot quicker than people were expecting. And so if all you're sort of doing is, you know, looking at, okay, only the 50th percentile outcome, right? Like only what's this guy's average NBA career look like? You know, yes, the average will tend towards 50th percentile. That's what 50th percentile means. But, you know, it's not just everybody finishing at the 50th percentile either. It's some guys do better and some guys do worse. And if you don't sort of have a handle on where guys might stand to improve and unlock serious areas of their game, or where guys might be overrated in terms of, hey, they knock down, you know, 30 of 50 threes and all of a sudden people are talking about them like they're, you know, the best 3-point marksman in the country. You know, you have to be somewhere down the middle, but if you're not at least looking at the positives, then you're sort of assuming that everybody's going to fail and looking for who's the quote unquote safest. Again, that doesn't always work either.
Yeah. And when we talk lottery tickets and, you know, 90th percentile outcome and, you know, what is the peak version of this prospect? It's so important to try and determine what's the feasibility that they actually hit that. You know, like when we talk about just like looking at Victor, you know, we saw what the 99th percentile outcome of him is, best player in the league. And we saw on film, statistically, it's like, okay, all the indicators are pointing to that. Then you get into the intel and it's like, okay, this dude's the real deal. And it would be almost more shocking if he didn't reach, you know, that 80th to 100th percentile outcome, than if he did. Whereas some of these other guys, it's like, man, if everything goes right, he can get there. But as I'm looking through this list of what needs to go right, it is getting longer and longer and longer and longer. So to kind of, you know, now push back on the opening of, you know, approach it with optimism, approach it with looking for the fun, looking for the excitement. You also have to be realistic about it. Yeah. And that's where the intel comes in. That, you know, just going to like a guy like Denny Avdija, who I vastly overrated. We don't need to get into the nuances of that. But like one of the reasons I was so high on him was that I really believed that he was going to be a good defender. He wasn't coming into the draft, but I thought the physical tools were good. The effort was good. And then you start watching some of his interviews and he starts talking about how he was never coached how to play defense and how his coaches just flat out told him, don't worry about that end of the floor. It's like, oh, okay, this is interesting. Now, if it seems like you want to defend, once you are coached on how to do that, what's the realistic possibility that you're going to hit those marks? And, you know, it's taken some time and there are bumps in the road, as there are with all prospects, but he's turned into a good defender. So trying to figure out that the feasibility of these guys reaching their ultimate upside and reaching that, you know, ceiling is so important and so much of what this draft is, especially in drafts like these where there are so many lottery tickets. A lot of the kind of tiebreakers are going to be, how realistic do I think it is that this guy can hit that, you know, upper percentile outcome?
So let's move into discussing Saloon specifically now and starting with the offense. And it would be pretty hypocritical to not start with the positives given the way that we, you know, went through the first 13 odd minutes of the podcast. So as you say in the article, the biggest selling point with Saloon's offense is his shooting potential. The key word there is potential. Now, you know, that on the surface doesn't sound like the most positive approach to things, but, you know, I think the idea here is that, you know, look, when he has the ball in his hands, it's, let's say, interesting. But yeah, when he's an off-ball player, there's a lot of good stuff that he does. And all of that is sort of unlocked by his shooting. You know, if he ends up being a 33.3% shooter as he was across all competitions this year, that's one thing. But, you know, if he's consistently out there beyond the arc, spacing the floor, that unlocks a lot of his sort of secondary stuff. I mean, you and I have talked so many times before about how much we love players who are great cutters on offense, and that's certainly a strength for him as well. And that's the kind of strength that only magnifies the impact of his shooting if he ends up, you know, growing into being above average to really solid. You know, maybe elite is a bit of a high end outcome for him, but he doesn't need to be like, you know, he doesn't need to be Reed Sheppard, right? Especially given his size. And the fact that he does a lot of secondary offensive stuff so well really meshes well with the idea that if he can continue to expand his shot, his offensive game looks a lot more positive overall.
Yeah. And his shot is honestly one of his skills that I was really skeptical on at the start of the year, just because we typically don't see guys that big necessarily shoot it that well. And I think it was one of his first games that I caught. There's a perfect angle where he was on the wing, camera angle was right behind him, and he was coming off a movement, and the mechanics were real funky when you like went freeze frame. I was like, oh God, no, like absolutely not. It also resulted in a horrid miss, but it's like, oh, this is rough. But then it's like, oh, okay, now that's kind of a one-off, because you just keep watching more and more. It's like, God, his mechanics are really consistent. They're really pretty. And he's not this dynamic shooter on ball necessarily, but the off-ball stuff, it's not just that he's standing in the corner shooting purely off the catch. He's shooting deep. He's shooting off of screens. He's relocating and kind of finding those open pockets on the perimeter. And overall, his jump shots in the 53rd percentile, 63rd percentile off the catch, 71st percentile off the catch when unguarded, and 20th percentile off the bounce. So it's like, okay. When we see his size, his athleticism, his motor, you know, the initial thing that we always want is, oh God, he would be fun as like this on-ball creator with that size, athleticism, you know, the on-ball scoring potential is through the roof. But it's like, but it might not be. As an off-ball scorer, though, an off-ball shooter, play finisher, that's where he really kind of starts getting me excited. And all of it stems from that ability to shoot off the catch really consistently.
I'm not sure if people are fed up with me bringing him up consistently or if people want me to bring him up more consistently because I get more excited when I get to talk about him. But a lot of that sort of discussion that you were just having about Salin's shooting reminds me of sort of what I've been thinking about the evolution of Daron Holmes' game this season, in the sense of, look, the fact that he's added the three-pointer to his game is a huge weapon for him going forward, a huge factor for him being able to fight his way into various different rotations. But also, and more, and to the point, it's not just that he's taking shots, it's the kinds of shots that he's taking, which would be the kinds of shots that he's taking at the NBA level, right? Like pick and pop threes, trailer threes, you know, at the top of the arc when left wide open kinds of threes. And it's a similar thing with Salin, where, okay, he's not great at shooting off the dribble. Guess what? He's not going to be dribbling that much, right? That's not going to be something that NBA teams are going to ask him to do unless he experiences sort of outlier growth in that regard. And so, you know, the baseline level of, look, what kind of shooter do you need, right? You know, it's one thing to say, oh, it'd be great if everybody in the lineup was a 40% shooter. Well, great. But like, you know, the example I use for this all the time is one of Rajon Rondo's seasons for the Kings where he shot 37% from three-point range. It was like, congratulations, you did that on two attempts per game. And the other 39 times that you had the ball wide open at the top of the arc and defenses were playing 4-on-5, that's not a positive for the team, right? And so, you know, with someone like Salin, it's not just that, you know, he's got the ability to shoot. It's, as you mentioned, you know, the consistency of his mechanics, the ability to be someone who can run and shoot off screens. The fact that his biggest weakness as a shooter is shooting off the dribble is not anywhere near as big of a deal as if, say, we were discussing a point guard prospect who we were expecting to have the ball in his hands all the time.
Yeah, and if you kind of go into scouting and evaluating Salin as this potential on-ball creator, on-ball scorer, I think you're just kind of misunderstanding the player, because even when we just look at what his kind of usage was with Chalet this year, I mean, his top four play types were spot up, which is 47% of his possessions, transition, cutting, and offensive rebounding. His most used on, you know, quote unquote on-ball play type was as the pick and roll ball handler, which he ran 13 possessions of this year. He's not that guy, and that's okay. Does that kind of limit what his ultimate ceiling is in an NBA context? Probably, but that doesn't diminish how valuable he can be to an NBA roster down the road, because, you know, I don't know if you've heard, but there's only one ball. So you have to have guys that are really high level play finishers who work their butt off, who do all the dirty work. And when you think about, you know, that spot up shooting, the relocating on the perimeter, and then also cutting consistently, crashing the offensive glass, that's the stuff that he really does at a high level and really thrives in doing.
Yeah. And, you know, the motion, I think, is a huge part of this of, you know, again, I think if people assume I'm talking about this year, they might think it's an insult. If people assume I'm talking about 5 years ago, they might think I'm insane. But the concept of, I mean, really, Steph Curry popularized this, but, you know, Klay Thompson is someone who had 60 point games where he dribbled the ball 11 times, right? A lot of, you know, what he did in that game was, you know, obviously he wasn't doing anything with the ball in his hands all that much, but, you know, him running around screens. I mean, Steph is the guy who, you know, is the most constant sort of relocation threat of, oh, you know, he gives up the ball and immediately runs to the other end of the court. And if you trail him for 22 seconds at second 23, he's going to sprint around that last screen. And if you don't catch it, the ball's going up and in, right? Like, there's a lot of value to that kind of player who, you know, isn't just someone who's standing around off ball, like, hey, I'm in the corner, pass the ball to me. I'm, you know, spacing the floor over here. Can't you see me spacing the floor over here with my hands up beyond the 3-point line? Like, the ability for him to, you know, not just be a solid cutter and a solid offensive rebounder, but to create defensive chaos just by running around and relocating. I mean, that's a huge part of being a valuable shooter, is not just being someone who is parked in the corner and sure, they'll make it when you kick it to them out there, but otherwise they're just sort of standing around waiting for the ball. NBA teams are moving more and more away from the sort of standing still in the corner waiting for the basketball kind of offensive player. And, you know, the fact that Saloon's already so good at movement and getting himself open is really positive. You know, even if the shooting numbers aren't quite what you would hope for going forward, a lot of the sort of fundamental stuff is there for him.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, and it's so rare for guys to consistently be able to stay perfectly on platform, not have to move, and receive a perfect pass. It's just not a realistic game setting. But those who can, you know, when the term movement shooting gets thrown out, we just immediately think of Jordan Hawkins, JJ Redick, you know, these guys who are sprinting off screens, and Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, you know. But there are also, you know, lesser forms of that where it's just simply relocating or making sure that you're adjusting your feet enough and your shot prep is good enough where when a pass does take you off your platform, you're able to adjust quickly enough, reset that platform and get a shot up without being really thrown off. And I think that Saloon kind of consistently showed that this year with his ability to kind of relocate on the perimeter, to adjust to inconsistent passes, to find those open pockets. That's the type of off-ball shooter that I think he really has a high possibility of achieving, because he's not going to be a guy that you're sending off, you know, floppy screens and all that kind of stuff. But when a guy drives and collapses the defense and he lifts out of the corner up, you know, up above the break, and a pass is an extra foot wider from where he's going, he's going to be able to kind of quickly reposition himself, get set, and then put up a three that you're going to be really happy with him taking.
Tyler Rucker isn't here, so I feel awkward bringing this up, but there's a sort of element of, you know, being able to work in the chaos, like being able to be a conductor of chaos, as it were, right? Of, okay, this play has broken down. You know, what am I doing? Am I reading the situation and saying, all right, you know, if I, you know, drop back out to the 3-point line, the defender is going to have to sink into the paint because someone's driving and that leaves me space. Like, you know, we talk all the time about, and I mean, I certainly use it to the point where people are fed up of it, of the idea of, you know, college and, you know, some lower professional leagues, it might be a game of feet, where in the NBA, it's a game of inches. The ability to not have to sort of sit there and process, like the ability to make a good decision quickly rather than just sort of waiting around and being like, you know, freezing, hesitating with the ball in your hands. Like, for all the weaknesses that Saloon might have on the offensive end, that at least is one where he's always got his head up and is always reactive. It's, you know, easier to sort of have positive thoughts about where that might go down the line than someone who just sort of looks lost out there, which, you know, he kind of does when he has the ball in his hands. But, you know, just purely in terms of being an off-ball player, he thrives in broken plays in a way that makes it sort of easier for me to project him as someone who, okay, he'll find a fit in an NBA offense. He'll be able to do things even if he is barely ever touching the ball.
Yeah, and that speaks to his motor and his work ethic, at least on the court. I haven't heard anything bad off the court by any means, but when you watch him play, he's not one of these guys where you ever forget that he's on the court. He's always one of the hardest working guys. He's always sprinting back in transition. He's always scrambling on defense. He's always crashing the offensive glass, trying to make himself available for teammates. He's doing the effort stuff. And that is a baseline. That alone gives you a really encouraging baseline of how a guy is can find a role on a team. Is he going to be a starter? Who knows? Maybe not. But that willingness to do all the dirty shit that no one else likes to do, that's huge. And that's what kind of carves out at a minimum 10 to 15 minutes a night. And then you add in the play finishing stuff, the rebounding, the defensive potential. That's where the minutes start seeing an uptick. That's where the responsibility starts seeing an uptick. So the shooting with him is really intriguing, but everything he does, and I think everything going forward with him, stems off of that just insane work rate that he has every time he steps foot on the court.
I think that's a perfect way of putting it. You know, there's the idea of, okay, you know, how do you sort of work your way up an NBA rotation? But to work your way up, you have to start, right? You have to, not start isn't be in the starting lineup, but, you know, you have to, as you said, be able to be a 10 to 15 minute rotation player. And then from there, you get the developmental reps you need on the court. You know, you get that sort of, you start building chemistry with, you know, whoever you're playing with in those limited minutes off the bench. And that's the point where, okay, you know, if you start showing significant improvement, and we'll get into some of the areas of improvement offensively in just a moment here. But, you know, if you're looking at it from that perspective, it's like, okay, you know, you to develop into the kind of player, especially for someone like Saloon, to develop into the kind of player that you might be, you know, on the higher end of the outcomes, you know, not even saying 90th, 95th, whatever, higher end percentile of those outcomes, you need to be able to play at all. And, you know, just getting on the court, you know, I talk all the time on here about sort of avenues to playing time, right? And with Saloon, you know, there's enough there sort of on both ends to make you think, all right, there's going to be some team that could use his sort of ability to make other players better as an off-ball guy, to, you know, help sort of space the floor, to run in transition, to put in that effort on the defensive end, as we'll get into later. You know, you have to start somewhere, right? If you're not, you know, a good enough defender to earn playing time for whatever coach you're playing for, then you're not going to get the developmental reps you need. And, you know, you might look like a bust, you might look like a flameout, when really you didn't do anything necessarily wrong. You just weren't, you know, you didn't have a wide enough variety of skills to find your way into a rotation.
Yeah. And so much of basketball is just effort. And are you willing to do what the guy next to you isn't? I know it's cliche, I know it's tacky, but it makes a difference. And it's, you know, so many coaches just fall in love with that stuff. They're not looking to waste their time trying to motivate guys and trying to get them to play hard. If you're out there doing that already on your own, coaches are going to gravitate towards that. And that's just what Saloon is every time he's out there.
So let's, again, just sort of quickly touch on some of the offensive areas of improvement before we move into the defense. And really a lot of it is, you know, everything beyond what we've talked about so far. You know, I think that's a bit of a mean way of putting it, but, you know, you mentioned in the piece, in the half court, he's shooting just 56.7% at the rim, which is not the kind of number you expect for someone of his size. And, you know, 7.1 on floaters, so 1 of 14, which is really beautiful numbers to see, and 19% on two-point jumpers, which, yikes. But, you know, you mentioned my favorite partial free throw truther thing. He is shooting 80.5% from the line. That's a very solid indication of touch. You know, mileage may vary on how much you buy into that, but certainly as someone who buys in on the higher end of free throw shooting being a good indication of touch, I'm certainly willing to buy in there. But the numbers on drives are hideous. And, you know, I think that goes into a lot of what we were talking about of, okay, he's probably not an on-ball guy. Like, you know, that's when you look at the numbers, and I'm going to let you read them for shock value here, but it's just really very clear that, okay, unless he makes almost unprecedented levels of improvements in that regard, that's not going to be a part of this game.
Yeah. So, and just to kind of touch on the drives, 112 of them, you know, I'm just going off of Synergy's info here, but 112 of them on the year, solid sample size, shooting 25.9%, true shooting percentage of 37%, and a turnover rate of 17.9%.
Oh, wow. He's cut down the turnover since the article came out.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. Was it over 18?
Yeah, no, it was 106 drives. So on the six extra drives, he didn't turn the ball over on any single one of them. So that's clear improvement right there.
Yeah, and it's tough. And it's all stuff that kind of speaks to just him not being an on-ball creator. That's not who he's going to be. But when we talk about, when we kind of go back to, you know, us being encouraged by the shooting, and you mentioned the free throw number, and I think that's more encouraging for him as a shooter and me trusting that he is going to continue to grow and be a real shooter down the line. The issue with that is that if you run him off the line, what can he do? And currently it's not a whole lot, at least positive. When he drew, you know, there are some flashes, there are some awesome highlights of him making some really fun kickouts or finishing through contact, but that's like one in every 20 attempts, basically. Everything in between those highlights is really concerning because there's really no in-between game for him right now. When he drives to the rim, it's typically without a plan. And what I mean by that is that he just kind of goes up into the crowd. He'll take off too early. He'll take off going way away from the rim. He rushes stuff. He gets really impatient. He's not composed. We see that in his turnover numbers. We see that in his at rim finishing numbers. I mean, he's shooting worse at the rim than Rob Dillingham this year in the half court. So when you run him off the line, what can he do? And currently I'm not sure it's a whole lot.
Yeah, that's, I think, really the key question is, you know, especially the last few years, we've seen NBA teams pretty aggressively move away from guys who can only do one thing. And, you know, again, the good news for Saloon is that he has a varied off-ball game, right? Like, it's not just he's parked in the corner and you're hoping that he'll, you know, knock down a three every once in a while. But, you know, the problem with that argument is, you know, again, the in-between game, much more important for a guy who's going to have the ball in his hands regularly. But as you said, if teams know, all right, we force him off the line and he's screwed, right? Then that's the kind of thing that genuinely can tank those 10 to 15 minutes a game, can make a coach say, all right, you know, it's not worth what you're providing for us to play you these 11 minutes because, you know, you keep turning the ball over because you keep dribbling it off your foot when you're forced off the line, right? That's, you know, of all the sorts of areas of his game that are areas for improvement, that's, I think, the one that might actually sink his NBA prospects more than almost anything else.
Yeah, and he's too big and too athletic for that to be the case. Because when you think, or when you see him on the court, it's like, my God, this dude is one of the biggest dudes out here. He's one of the best athletes out here. When he gets downhill, he should be a force. He should be a monster at finishing through guys, at putting guys on posters, and he just doesn't. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating because you see how hard he plays, how physical he plays, but then once he gets downhill, it's like stuff speeds up too much and he kind of panics. So I'm not quite sure what the feasibility in actually improving that stuff is. Really improving as, you know, at rim finishing craft is difficult. It's really hard. It is one of the toughest things to do, especially when you're not as innately skilled as, you know, a lot of these guards are. Like when we look at someone like Rob Dillingham, his at rim finishing numbers aren't outstanding, but he has so much skill and craft and creativity that I trust he's going to figure it out in some respect. I don't use any of those words when I think of Saloon and his offense. And the fact that he's not consistently throwing out these big time dunks and constantly getting to the line and showing off this physicality, he's letting the defense off the hook a lot because he could be punishing them so much by just really pressuring that rim with the intensity that he plays the rest of the game with. And it just doesn't show up in that area.
It's interesting because I feel like this is something that I see much more frequently with college bigs than international bigs, just in the sense of the jump from high school to NCAA, particularly Division I, is so dramatic in a way that, you know, jumping up from the youth team or the B team, you know, to the A squad in an international league is nowhere near as big of a jump. And, you know, you can go on for days about the number of guys who were, you know, top recruits in their high school class who they get to the NCAA and they realize, oh, I can't just dunk over everybody on every play anymore. I'm not 6 inches taller and have a 10 inch greater vertical than everybody else on the court. This is like, I don't know how to finish. I mean, I feel bad because I sort of rely on examples for these sorts of things. And so I'm dragging the names of these guys through the mud like every other episode. But, you know, Cliff Alexander is the example that always comes up for me of he dominated in high school and he gets to Kansas and he can't dunk all over everybody like he always used to. And all of a sudden, instead of being 6'9", which is massive for a high school center, he's an undersized 6'9" center in the NCAA. And he never figured enough of it out to make an NBA career for himself. And, you know, again, that's sort of a lower end example. Again, I think there's so much else that Saloon does that Cliff Alexander did not, which, you know, I think is indicative for the story here. But yeah, there's sort of an adjustment that I can sort of allow for of, okay, you know, this freshman big didn't finish anywhere near as well, you know, year one in college as they did in high school. But man, that's such a massive jump in competition. Like, you know, I understand it's going to be a bigger adjustment. The fact that it's a smaller adjustment for Saloon and he's still not quite there is, I think, I'm a bit more concerned than I might be if he were, say, a freshman at Texas doing all this.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just tough because you can't be a one-trick pony on offense anymore. And if he's not finishing around the rim, it's like, come on. Like, you're way too big. You're way too big. You're way too strong. You're way too athletic for that to be the case. So maybe it's just a mindset thing. Maybe it's just, hey, once he gets more games and the game starts slowing down for him a little bit and that confidence rises in him a little more, then it's like, oh, okay, here we go. This isn't that hard. Like, let me just go finish through these smaller human beings in front of me. Because for most of the time, that's the case with him. But he's got to figure out some other way to kind of learn how to finish off plays, because just being a shooter, it's not going to be good enough, because his defense isn't at a place yet where just being a shooter is going to be probably feasible.
That's a perfect opportunity to transition into talking about his defense. So let's talk about his game on the defensive end of the floor. And I'm just going to start where you start the defense section, because I think it wraps all of this up into a nice, neat little bow. The defensive end of the floor is simultaneously the messiest and most important aspect of Saloon's game.
He has to figure out how to defend. At that size, that athleticism, he could be an awesome defender. Theoretically, he could be. It seems like he wants to be. He has no idea what he's doing on that end of the floor, though, unfortunately. So much of the positive stuff that he contributes on defense is purely through effort. It is just hustle plays. It is just physical tools. And that's important. That's encouraging to me that he's not taking that side of the floor off, that he just doesn't care. I never get that vibe with him about any aspect of his game, honestly. But fundamentally, awareness-wise, processing speed, consistency, just none of it is there right now, unfortunately.
The edit will make the dramatic pause before Metcalf proceeded with his answer seem a lot shorter than it actually was. No, but I mean, in all seriousness, I think there's an element to which, you know, and you and I have talked about this many, many times, and I'm sure we will many, many times again, of such a huge part of defense is just being willing to put in the effort. And especially when you have the physical tools that Saloon has, you know, you combine that with the effort and that takes you a very long way. But the flip side of that is, you know, effort is far more of a positive than it is a negative on defense, but it can be a negative. Like, mm-hmm. You know, there are guys who, you know, and granted some of this, you know, it mileage may vary depending on the player, right? But a lot of times guys who have really high effort levels defensively can also be very jumpy. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, especially if you're sort of a four-ish, I would say, like Saloon, like probably going to play more four than anything else at the NBA level, you know, you need to simultaneously be able to help as a rim protector while also not fouling consistently. You need to be able to switch out onto smaller guys and not get blown past, at least be able to contain them somewhat on every possession. And you know, again, the effort will take him a long way. The physical tools will take him a long way. But, you know, he's taking himself out of plays by being as hyperactive as he is. And that's the point where effort can start to hurt. Like, just effort alone leads to, again, all of these sorts of things where, you know, as you mentioned, his fundamentals are poor. You know, his defensive footwork his defensive footwork is pretty inconsistent. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, if a ball handler knows, okay, you know, I get him to bite on the first fake because he's going to bite on the first fake every time.
Yeah.
He's a lot easier to deal with. And again, the effort that's such a positive starts, you know, having a sort of negative effect in a small manner, but in enough of a manner that it sort of takes away from the positives that it does help provide.
And he's just so desperate to make the right play, which again, is a good thing in totality, but on a play-by-play basis, it also leads to him way over rotating, which then makes his closeouts even longer, which is then kind of compounded with his desire to block a shot, which is then exploited by a simple pump fake and sends him flying into the third row. And it's just that kind of stuff every single time where it's like, man, you are really easy to manipulate on this end of the floor. Fundamentally, the feet are constantly crossing. His defensive stance is him typically bent over at the waist, not necessarily sitting down in a stance. He is a little higher waisted, so that, you know, there are some physical limitations there. But then that innate desire to just not give up a drive also leads him to overly scrambling and panicking and screwing up his footwork even more and making him even more unbalanced, where a simple crossover or step back just sends him the wrong direction way too easily. So it's, I really want to believe that it's, you know, I kind of mentioned Denny at the top, but I really want to believe that it's a similar case where he's just never really been taught how to defend, given how big and athletic and hard he plays. But there's a lot of work that has to go in on that end for him.
Now, stop me if you've heard this before, but his off-ball work is a lot better than his on-ball work. And
yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, and I think that's the key here, is sort of similarly, like, I don't think, especially given his, you know, size and presumed position, you know, I don't think he's going to be asked to be, okay, you know, you are our, you know, I don't particularly follow football that closely anymore, but, you know, I know enough about football to know that, you know, you have your shutdown corner that you stick on the guy and try and erase from the game, right? That's not going to be what Saloon does. And so the fact that he, you know, seems at least better equipped to be a solid off-ball defender sooner rather than later is, I think, a more important skill for him to be able to be good at earlier on. But, you know, again, even being that solid of an off-ball guy, you know, part of the concept of being an off-ball switch defender is you got to switch onto the guy with the ball sometimes. And, you know, you can do so much on, you know, the first 18 seconds of the possession. And then if you get swapped onto a guy who blows by you immediately, all that sort of goes to waste. So, you know, there's improvement that needs to be made, but I think there's a similar sort of story with his off-ball offense in that the stuff that he needs to be good to sort of get on the floor, he's got a solid enough baseline at, and then there's a lot of stuff that needs to be figured out. But certainly for me anyway, there's reason for hope given that the baseline of where he needs to be better is where he is better rather than sort of the areas of improvement.
Yeah, and just to kind of stick with that football analogy, he's not the shutdown corner, but he does have a lot of potential to be like that ball hawk safety where he's more that the low man, the weak side defender, and he is really good and intent about staying vertical at the rim right now. So yeah, he still fouls a little too much, but more of that is from him getting handsy or too jumpy. His verticality, I think, is really good. He's really consistent about tagging the roller and making that rotation from the weak side, being really active as a low man, and kind of disrupting shots at the rim, getting in the way for those guys. And he does work on his recoveries. It's just that his over rotations lead to longer and more sloppy closeouts. So some of that can be corrected in time and coaching and direction and chemistry and all of that kind of stuff. So I think everything you're saying with the off ball stuff, having that higher ceiling, that higher, potential of immediate impact is 100% true, because the desire is there, the tape is there, the consistent effort is there. It's just kind of fine tuning a lot of the little things.
So let's wrap up and talk about sort of the outlook here. And, you know, all of the process is interesting, but this, I think, is where it gets particularly interesting because, you know, as you mentioned in the piece, the more people you talk to, the wider the range of opinions on Saloon and genders, right? And that's, I think, the interesting part here is that, you know, with every prospect, there are the people who buy in and there are the people who don't, right? But, you know, the range between them tends to be smaller than I think it is for Saloon. And I think a lot of that is because of everything we've talked about, right? There's a decent baseline sort of floor of off-ball skills on both ends that, okay, you know, this is the foundation of a solid NBA rotation player. And then really the question just becomes, okay, but first of all, how solid is that foundation? And second of all, can he improve in the areas that he needs to be more than just, well, he's got the foundation, but he's got X, but he's got Y, but. And, you know, as you say in the piece, if he hits, the odds of him being a quote unquote steal for where he ends up drafted are pretty high. You know, the flip side of that being if a team buys in on him way too high, he could be one of the biggest disappointments of the lottery. Because I think if he goes outside the lottery, I mean, again, the odds of non-lottery picks hitting at all is slim enough that the odds of him being a bust is pretty small if he ends up going 20, at least in my mind. But again, there's just so much about him that's theoretical, that's, you know, there's the potential here. There's the baseline here. He's shown some skill in this area, right? And I think, as you mentioned, there's somewhat of a cap on his ceiling in the sense that he's not going to have the ball in his hands that much unless he makes pretty much unprecedented improvements in that regard, right? But Jaylen Brown exists. There are guys who have absolutely no idea what to do with the ball in their hands that figure it out. And, you know, I don't think Saloon is likely to have that same path to Jaylen Brown, because I don't think anyone is likely to have that same path. But, you know, the baseline of skills that he does already have, there's, again, there's the foundation of a solid NBA rotation player. And the question becomes, is there room for more? And what would that more look like?
Yeah. And that's where it gets tricky, because the word that you use that I kind of keep attaching to him is theoretical. Theoretically, he's a freaking insane prospect that you should be, you know, sprinting to the podium to pick. But so much of it is, well, you know, we talked about the feasibility of hitting that up, that those upper percentile outcomes. And I'm not sure how feasible that necessarily is with him. But if we if he kind of comes into the league and goes to a place that's patient with him and really focuses on developing those defensive tools and then just be the chaotic play finisher that you are, that's where it's like, okay, there's some legitimate 3-and-D potential here with you. And that's the outcome and the outlook that I try and really use with him going forward. So I've cooled on him a lot, unfortunately, throughout this season, just because so many of those inconsistencies and the holes and the red flags of this dude doesn't have on-ball equity necessarily, barring, you know, some outlier development here, it just kind of inevitably makes you fall down the rankings. And, you know, some outlets have him super high. Some of the NBA people that we've talked to are a lot more skeptical on it. The range of his draft possibilities come draft night, I think, are anywhere from freaking 5 to 30. Nothing would surprise me with him. But if he kind of falls and there really aren't those expectations on him, I think that's where I get a little more excited about his potential development, where, you know, maybe he goes to a bad team who has multiple first round picks in the 20s. And by the end of the year, he's getting some, you know, 15, 20 minutes a night. And we're seeing some of the flashes. So it's like, oh, this is fun. And then by year 2 and 3, he really starts to make those developments as that third or fourth scoring option and a legitimate kind of devastating weak side defender. Then it's like, okay, this is fun. This is what we wanted to see from you. But if you're going into it with him being a top 5, top 10 guy, that probably means that you're looking at him having on-ball equity, being a potential 1, 2, 3 guy on a good team eventually. And I'm just not sure that he has that type of realistic upside. And I hope that doesn't come off as an insult, because there are so few players in the league currently who have that ability, let alone prospects who haven't even played a minute of NBA basketball.
I completely agree with what you said, and I'll take it even a step further. I think my optimism about Saloon's NBA future is negatively correlated with where he gets drafted. The later he gets drafted, the more optimistic I am going to be about his NBA future, because that means that a team is going to be willing to be more patient with him. They are, as you said, not expecting him to have that on-ball equity. It's not just going to be, yeah, all right, we'll throw you the ball because I guess it's better than Jordan Poole having it and figure it out, right? That's not going to lead to good outcomes for him. But, you know, the flip side, again, I mean, if he I mean, you mentioned the team with bad team with multiple picks in the 20s. And the first team that came to mind for me was Utah. You know, there's a bit of a positional logjam there for him, but that kind of concept, I think, makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, a better team, but Indiana has, you know, a few late picks in the first round, you know, due to trades. And that would be a really fun spot for him to end up, because Tyrese Haliburton could help him with a whole lot of those, you know, sort of offensive issues, and certainly mitigate any sort of desire for him to ever have the ball in his hands. You know, there are situations where if I think it through, it's like, wow, this could really work out great for him.
Yeah.
The thing is, pretty much all of them are later in the first round rather than earlier.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And it sucks because, and fit is everything. Obviously, you know, the raw talent and the player themselves matters immensely. But
of course, yeah,
so many careers get derailed or elevated because of where they end up. And I think he's going to be one of these guys where the second after he gets picked, where they're gonna be like, oh, okay, that's fun, I like that. Like I can see, you know, the long-term vision with him. Or it's like, oh boy, this might get messy quick. So I think like every prospect, you have to have the long-term view, and I really think that he kind of personifies that just as much, if not more, than anyone else in this draft.
All right. Anything else you want to talk about before we wrap this one up?
No, just noceilingsnba.com. Go check it out.
There you go. That cuts one of the plugs out of my next section. Appreciate that. All right. He is Tyler Metcalf. You can find him on Twitter at TMetcalf11. And you can, of course, find his written work on noceilingsnba.com, as he already mentioned. And be sure to check out his piece, Tijan Saloon is the Ultimate Lottery Ticket, that we talked about in this episode. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback, feel free to reach out to me about the deep dives portion of the podcast at NBA Johnson on Twitter or nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening. Cool.